Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's Tuesday ahead of Thanksgiving. Thanks very much for tuning in. I'm Steve Bertrand, and thanks to Suzanne Muchin, who filled in for me yesterday while I was tied up in some meetings, which is always fun. John Najarian is on a phone line, right, John? You enjoy meetings, don't you?
You see your time, right?
That's right. Actually, it was a nice time. We did a couple of sort of group things and enjoyed it, and probably better off for it. But I wouldn't mind being here either. Earlier today, the Dow crosses the 19,000 mark, and everyone's talking about what a sort of a milestone this is. Then it drops below it. Now, it seems to me that that's the way these things usually happen, right? They go up, they dance with the milestone, they drop below, and then achieve it a day or two later. Is 19,000 significant, or what does that matter?
It's only significant because it is just as you said, the first time we crossed it. Usually you do get people that come in and say, well, at a big round number, I'm going to take some profits. We saw it in bonds last week when the bonds got up to a yield, the 10-year of about 250, and the same thing here with 19,000, although not really much of a sell-off. It did pull back through it, and I agree with you that in all likelihood, if things continue along the path that they're on, with retailers reporting good numbers and with home sales as strong as they are right now, I think that is additional wind in our sails.
The markets have looked very good since Donald Trump's election 2 weeks ago. And now I'm reading on some of the sites today, and I don't know if this is how you pick your cabinet, but they said that there will be a real pop if Mitt Romney is chosen as Secretary of State. If they pick Mitt Romney, I hope they pick him because he'll be a good secretary. But if that's a byproduct, I guess that's not bad, right? Do you see it happening that way?
Well, I think a lot of folks are reading those tea leaves, Stephen, the same way that you and probably many of us in the media are looking at it, and that is that it's a rather than an alt-right or a very conservative pick, it's a guy that's been in the middle for much of his political career. And so as the person that represents our interests overseas, if indeed he is the Secretary of State, I think people feel pretty comfortable with how he would do it. And he's not perceived in the same way as Mr. Trump, who is a, you know, fly by the seat of his pants, say whatever's on his mind kind of guy. So I think it's a more stable, if you will, pick that many on both sides could support.
You know, this is probably an aside, maybe not the right topic for our conversation, but what do you make of the whole Rudy Giuliani thing? It looked like he was doing flying so high, had the president-elect's ear, and now it looks like he's kind of on the outs.
Well, you know, Mr. Giuliani's had a lot of business dealings. No one has questioned the business dealings that he did, but now as far as could he be a, for instance, Secretary of State if he's taken money from many of the same governments that he'd be dealing with, it probably is flying too close to the same sun that Mr. Trump accused Hillary Clinton of flying next to. So I think that's one of the things that comes back to bite him. I will be surprised, though, if he's not a confidant and have some sort of significant role in Mr. Trump's administration.
Let's look at what's going on today. Medtronic was up after a nice earnings report and not so much so for Dollar Tree. Is that correct?
Other way around.
Oh, OK. You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, I read that wrong.
No, that's quite all right. Medtronic just had a horrific profit-taking session today, stock falling dramatically, and not because they didn't have good earnings. They did. They beat by just slightly on revenue as well as bottom line, but the unfortunate thing for them is that that was a very much an outperforming sector, the devices side of healthcare, which Medtronic's, of course, whether it's cardiac or other types of devices that they implant, that's where they make the bulk of their profits. And I think people were looking at this saying, I'd rather get into some of the beaten up sectors of healthcare. And I think they were rushing for the door all at once in this case.
I was reading about a report from Goldman Sachs yesterday. And when I saw it, I wanted to ask you about it because we've talked about stock buybacks in the past, you know, whether companies invest in workers and research and infrastructure or whether they buy back stock to improve the price of their stock. And Goldman Sachs says the buybacks will go up, I think it was like something like 30% next year when compared to this year. I think this year they were down a little bit from the year before. But what do you make of that? Is that a good thing, a bad thing, or just a fact of life?
On the one hand, I like it if somebody's willing to put their money where their mouth is. But I generally like it, Stephen, if it's their money and not our money as shareholders. So I like it when Jamie Dimon did what he did when his stock was hit. And he was able to buy his shares, I think, at $52 a share. And he just basically bought millions of dollars worth of stock. And that was the Jamie bottom for J.P. Morgan. I think a share buyback doesn't have that same impact as it does when a, you know, whether it's a founder like Jack Dorsey with Twitter or whether it's a significant executive like Jamie Dimon, when they put their cash down, I think it speaks volumes. When they're investing our cash, if they don't have a better use of the cash, Warren Buffett, I believe, told Stephen Jobs that when Steve asked him, what do I do with all this cash? He said, well, you either pay it out in a dividend, give money to strangers, if you will, or you give it to them through the share repurchase program. And a lot of us don't really think that's, other than shrinking the number of shares outstanding, does much for the stock, really. So I'm not a big fan of it.
All right, real quick, you have a suggestion for today? What are you buying?
Sure. Today I was buying Delta Airlines. Speaking of Warren Buffett, he was buying Delta Airlines 2 weeks ago. We were already long it, but we were adding to positions today. Some significant upgrades of the stock over the last three sessions. Citigroup was 2 days ago. Today it was Imperial Capital, upgraded them, put the target at 52 from 44. So we were buying the stock in the mid-49 level, I believe, during the day today.
John Najarian, thanks very much for talking to us today. You can find out more from John at John Najarian on Twitter, at Najarian Family Offices, too. Thanks, John.
Thank you,
Steve. Hey, have a great Thanksgiving, man.
Oh, you have a great Thanksgiving, too. Everybody out there, be safe and happy.
Thank you. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Andrew Herman is here from DNA Info Chicago, and he likes to talk about openings and closings. We've got one of each today, but I want to start with the opening. Mm-hmm. And this kid, 19-year-old Joshua Marin,
yeah,
I think, is a cobbler, comes from a cobbler family, his grandfather, his father. And now he's opened up a shop. Is it where, Lincoln Square?
Yeah, so it's in Lincoln Square at 4542 Northwestern. It's called Fix Your Kicks.
And he specializes in fixing Air Jordans,
right,
which he says aren't very well made.
Right, that's right. He said as much as you pay for them, they actually aren't that well made, according to him.
But it's a sort of a introduction to this weird economic ecosystem of these shoes.
Yeah. Well, the first Air Jordans came out in 1985, and there's been, I think, 31 different versions since then. And the originals you can find online, and they can go for $1,500 to $2,000 a pair. Yeah. I mean, even a new pair is $185 to $200. So they're pretty expensive to begin with.
And that's one thing. So there's that. But mm-hmm. then here's this 19-year-old kid who's got the wherewithal to rent a storefront, open it up, and he's making a go. He says he knows college isn't his thing, and he's making a go of it.
Yeah, it's amazing. He says that in addition to fixing your Air Jordans, he'll also redesign them completely. And there's some pictures of them on the DNA Info website. But he says he's bought these old Air Jordans that are all beat up for $10-$12 on like Goodwill or whatever. He'll refurbish them, and he's been able to get $100-$120 for them.
And his landlord says he's a bright young guy, great guy to work with, and just seems to be a real up-and-comer.
Right. You wouldn't think there would be a market for cobblers these days, but Joshua Marine's giving it a shot.
Fix Your Kicks. It's in the 4500 block of Northwestern Avenue. So buy some Air Jordans, mess them up, and then go take them into the...
Right.
He'll do your regular shoes too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he does do regular shoes as well.
All right, let's go then from there to Humboldt Park in Grandma Jay's Local Kitchen, which is another story of a person trying to make a go of it, bring something new in, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah, so she opened the place at 1552 North Kedzie about 5 years ago, the owner Layla Malaya Kay. And she's had a tough go of it. It's been vandalized three times in the last 5 years. In June, somebody scrawled, "Get out of Humboldt Park. Don't gentrify us. We don't want to be Wicker Park."
Which isn't what she was after, right?
No, it was not. And then somebody threw a brick through the window. And then in November, somebody broke in and stole her antique cash register that had an entire $1.25 in it. And over the weekend, she has declared she has had enough of the restaurant business.
That's too bad. A single mom, and she tried to do things like with story times and things like that to get moms and kids in the restaurant, but it just isn't going to work out for her.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a often repeated University of Ohio study about restaurants out there, and it says 60% of all restaurants go out of business within the first year, 80% go out within the first 5 years.
Wow.
So it is a very, very tough business. They're hard to manage. There's a lot of people coming and going. It's hard to maintain the quality of the food, and most restaurateurs don't have very good accounting skills, according
right.
to people who study this.
This is not what brings them to the business.
Right. They don't really understand the coming and going of cash.
So she announced on Facebook that this last weekend would be her last. And
mm-hmm.
she said Saturday and Sunday open from 9 a.m. to, well, let's see. This may be a good time to BYOB it. So
right.
I hope that she went out with a celebration.
No doubt.
All right, Andrew Herman, DNA Info, thanks for coming by.
Okay.
Have a great Thanksgiving, friend.
You too.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, everyone talks about Thanksgiving food, right? You got the turkey, the stuffing, the mashed potatoes, and, of course, that mold of cranberry. The cranberry mold, I don't know if you'd eat it that way. I prefer it fresh myself. But cranberries are a big part of the holidays, and a big part of the cranberry crop comes from just north of the Illinois border in Wisconsin. In fact, 60%, I think, last time I saw, of U.S. cranberries are grown in Wisconsin. Tom Lochner is the executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers, and he joins us on a phone line now. Tom, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
How did I do? 60%, right? Is that it?
Well, we're probably going to push 65 this year.
Not too shabby.
A little bit, and yeah, not too shabby.
It was a nice season for growing, right? You had a good weather season?
Yeah, the weather here in Wisconsin was good for all things green and growing, including cranberries. I think just about anybody that planted any type of garden or any type of crop had a very good growing season.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that because I think down here was pretty similar. We had a wild tomato year, unlike anyone we've had, so it was good everywhere. I read something that you said about the crop, and I want you to explain it for me, because I think one of the things I want to talk to you about is just how cranberries grow and how they're harvested. I think it's a pretty cool story. Mm-hmm. But you referred to ice conditions that protected the buds over the winter. So what does that mean? Do the cranberry plants, do they grow under the ice, or how does that work?
Well, cranberries are a perennial plant, so they grow year to year. Once you get them planted, they will produce a crop indefinitely if they're well managed. And one of the challenges that growers face is once we harvest the fruit, we still have to manage the plant that's out there, because the fruit bud, which contains next year's crop, is set on the vine in August and September. So we're actually growing two crops in the fall, the one that we're harvesting and also the one that will grow next year. So we have to protect that fruit bud over the winter. Now, cranberries don't grow in water. That's one of the common misconceptions.
Right.
They do. It's a dry culture. But when we get that first snap of cold weather, you know, it gets cold here, 20
sure.
below. Up until last week, we didn't know if it was going to get cold, but we were enjoying, you know, 50 and 60 degree weather. But once we get that first sub-zero snap, the growers will flood the beds where the cranberries grow and cover the vines completely with water. They like to make a 12 to 16, 18-inch block of ice, layer of ice that sits on top of the vines, and that will protect that fruit bud over the winter.
Ah, okay. So when you're referring to the ice, you're referring to, in a way, not man-made, but man-enhanced ice, the flood. I didn't understand it that way.
Yeah, it's kind of an ice mulch, I think, is one way to think about it,
okay.
that we use ice as
yeah.
a mulch to protect the vine.
So you say that they grow, it's a dry crop, and yet we see them harvested. Well, we're told they grow in bogs, and then they're harvested right in water. So is a cranberry plant not naturally a bog plant?
Well, cranberries are a native wetland plant.
Okay.
And actually, the early, going back to Native Americans, harvested them in the wild and in the wetlands here in Wisconsin after European settlement and during European settlement. They were a trade item between the fur traders, actually, that came in and the Native Americans. And over time, Europeans, the early growers, found stands of wild cranberries in central Wisconsin and worked to enhance and protect those wild stands of cranberries in the what was called the Great Swamp here in central Wisconsin, which was thousands of acres from an old glacial lake that sit here in central Wisconsin. But those wild stands of cranberries were native wetland plants. They like to be close to the water, but they can tolerate flooding, but they don't grow in water. They're not an aquatic plant. They're what's called an obligate hydrophyte.
Well, that's what I was going to say too, Tom, the obligate hydrophyte.
Yeah,
but
that's our go-to position.
But they're harvested in water, right? Do you flood the bog to float them, to harvest them, or what's the, because I see the pictures, right? I mean, I know I've seen the pictures of them floating.
Yeah, we what growers will do in the fall is they will flood the beds to essentially the cranberry itself has four air pockets in it. So if people buy fresh cranberries for Thanksgiving,
right,
they break them open, they'll see there's four air pockets in there that contain the seeds. But cranberries will float. And what growers found 100 years ago was is if they flood the beds, that gets the cranberries that grow on a low trailing vine, they get those berries to pop up in the water, and then they're available. They're still attached to the vine, but we can go through with mechanical harvesters and remove them from the vines, and then they float on the water, and then you get those pictures that you see.
Beautiful pictures.
Beautiful pictures. You got red fruit on blue water with the blue sky and the fall color in the background. It's a great time of year in Wisconsin for cranberry harvest. So we do harvest them in water, and that process speeds up how we can harvest. We can get through the crop a lot quicker than if we were to try and dry harvest. Plus, we get all the fruit that's out there.
I'm sure you're happy to sell a cranberry any way you can, but it's just a shame to eat it out of a can because they're just beautiful, you know. And they're easily made.
Oh, sure. And I don't, to be honest with you, I don't buy cranberry sauce. Although cranberry sauce is, we find it's pretty good to put on a sandwich, a turkey sandwich or something like that, you know, instead of, as well as just eating it on Thanksgiving. You can consume it during the year. But at our home, we make a cranberry sauce from fresh berries.
Right. Now, I read somewhere, right, that you would think that the holidays are the biggest time for cranberries, but that's not necessarily true?
Right. About 3-5% of the crop is sold as fresh fruit in the bags that people will purchase in the store during the Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday season. The rest of the crop ends up in a freezer and then is processed during the throughout the year. We'll make dried cranberries, we'll make cranberry sauce, we'll make cranberry juice drinks and products like that. And so we sell most of the fruit outside of the holiday season. Although the holiday seasons are the biggest time and the biggest market for all cranberry products, I think it was estimated once that about 20% of cranberry sales occur between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Is the harvest in now? Are you all done?
We're all done. We finished up most growers, and the peak of harvest was over in late October. We had some folks who were finishing up a couple of weeks ago, some of the fresh fruit growers who it's a longer process to harvest fresh fruit, so they're out there a little bit later. But the harvest is all wrapped up.
All right, one more. What's this with the elk?
Well, we have a wide variety of wildlife that lives on and near cranberry marshes, and most marshes are in pretty rural or isolated locations. And in Jackson County in central Wisconsin, the Department of Natural Resources is establishing a herd of Rocky Mountain elk. And once they released them into the Jackson County forest, the first place they went were the cranberry farms. Our growers have had concerns about damage that elk may cause to not only walking around on the vines and crushing fruit or eating fruit or browsing, but they also dig into the dikes and cause washouts and knock over sprinkler heads and things like that. So we've been working with our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to develop abatement practices to keep the elk from coming onto the cranberry marshes and cause damage. You know, growers love to see wildlife, and we've got just about everything you can imagine. We have wolves, we have loons, we have trumpeter swans, we have sandhill cranes, we have whooping cranes, we have...
Well, Tom, we have loons, too. We just send them to Congress down here.
we've got a few roaming around, but so we have all of these, this wildlife, growers are glad to see it, but elk present a different dynamic. They're, you know, 800-pound animals.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, so we've been working with the department to try and protect our growers that are in that release area from having their crop put at risk.
Tom Lochner is the executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
No, I appreciate it. Anytime. Have a and hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving and makes cranberries part of that Thanksgiving dinner.
We will. Tom Lochner, thanks very much.
You bet.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks, so. It is 12:53 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook. I need to work on my Facebook page. I need to go public a little bit there, but you can still follow me at Steve Bertrand Travel on Facebook. So there's that. All right. I said earlier, did Christmas save Rockford? I don't know about that. John Groh is with us on a phone line now. He is the CEO at the Rockford Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. He's been on with us before. We talked about this big sports complex that they built there. John, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks for inviting me back.
All right. How about it? Did Christmas save downtown Rockford?
It certainly has played a great role in the revival of our downtown community, for sure.
We're getting into the Black Friday, Cyber Monday, a Small Business Saturday, all of that shopping stuff. And on Small Business Saturday, you guys have this Stroll on State festival. I think it started, 3 or 4 years ago, and it's been a huge success. Tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the fourth year for Stroll on State, which is a kickoff of the holiday season. And a big piece of it is really to celebrate Small Business Saturday and to encourage folks to discover the entrepreneurs who are opening up shop in our downtown in a really magical way where folks come down for visits with Santa and the tree lighting and ice skating and horse and wagon rides, but also getting into and exploring the restaurants and the retail boutiques that are in downtown Rockford.
All different sorts of towns do this. We had advertisements for the Deer Park Town Center. They had a big festival, I think it was last weekend. Tell me, though, I mean, sort of joking about Christmas saving downtown Rockford, but tell me about the impact, because this has had a genuine economic positive year-round impact on the city of Rockford.
It has, and we're thrilled with that. We started with this idea a couple of years ago to kick off the holiday season, and last year more than 65,000 people came to the event, which is just a six-hour-long event on Small Business Saturday. And our retailers, our restaurateurs, they tell us that not only is that day like their 13th month, they do so much business in one day, it's like a typical month.
Wow!
But that the people who are coming down from all over our region are finding them and coming back, throughout the year. And that for any business, repeat business is so important. So the fact that we can have this massive holiday experience that is festive and joyous, and that it has benefits of building business for our business owners year-round is awesome.
Now, I think you just said 65,000 last year. I see you're expecting 80,000 this year. Is that optimistic?
The first year we expected 5,000 to 10,000 people, and 30,000 showed up.
Wow!
And it just keeps growing. So really, we're just planning for more hot chocolate to be sold, more horse and wagon rides, more visits with Santa, and so 80,000 is optimistic, and it might even be conservative.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the micro and macro here, because I would imagine, as you said, for a lot of these shop owners, it's their 13th month. They do very well. But when you look at the bigger picture, as you do, coming out to 12 months, this is the sort of festival or event that sort of plants seeds in people, that brings them back, brings businesses back.
Absolutely. You know, and that's part of, you know, economic development and community development is, you know, providing experiences like this that reorient people to the downtown of any community, and, you know, let alone Rockford's downtown. And, you know, we look at what happens to property tax values, what happens to sales taxes in the community, what happens to job growth. You know, Rockford's been leading the state in job growth for the past 18 months. And so these things are all, you know, part of economic development strategy in the community, whether it was sports tourism, like we talked about a couple weeks back, or having a strategy about bringing people back to the center of the community for the holiday season.
I'm afraid to tell everyone that there's this big Etsy festival because my daughter's going to want to go.
It is like that. And actually, Rockford has a strategic partnership on the city level between our mayor and the CEO of Etsy that's developed over the past couple of years, supporting micro entrepreneurs, and that continues to grow. And many of those entrepreneurs are part of our holiday market during Stroll On State.
All right, John, what the heck? I'm happy to help Rockford. How do people find out more information?
The best way is to go to strollonstate.com. You can see the schedule. The event runs from 3 o'clock until 9 o'clock. If you can't get here over Stroll On State weekend, which always happens the Saturday after Thanksgiving, folks can check out what to see and do in the Rockford area at gorockford.com.
John Groh, thanks very much for joining us today. Good luck on Saturday.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good holiday.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.